Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 Podcast Network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast and check out all the other podcasts that are living over there. While you're over there, make sure you check out all the new things that we're doing. By new things, I mean the same things, but they're always new. Daily articles, a new article every day. There's new videos up there all the time. Go over to the YouTube channel. You can check out a bunch of new videos over there. New academies that have been filmed are coming out soon. Make sure you check out those things. Buy some of Chad's books. All this kind of stuff. And while you're over there, you can go over to that donate button. So, you know, Chad and I can keep the lights on. You know, so that's important because, you know, we got to live in houses. We got to keep the lights on. You know, the gas bill still coming in. Electric bill still coming in. I know. It's terrible. I don't know if you know this. I tried to tell the gas company, Chad. I said, hey, I'm doing the Lord's work over here trying to talk about the Old Testament. They sent me a bill anyway. They did not care.
Same thing happened to me. I tried. Same thing here in New Braunfels.
Yeah. They weren't interested in sponsoring.
It's like they live by the law.
They do. They have not repented and believed the gospel. So if you want to hit that donate button, you know, no, we don't play any ads on the podcast. We had offers to, but we don't want to do that. We don't want to bog you down in ads. And we don't have a paywall. It's not like if you listen to this and you want to go back to see what we have to say about Exodus, you have to, get a membership and all the backlog episodes are back there. No, we don't do any of that. And that's all made possible by supporters. And you can become one by hitting that donate button. And if you are one, thank you so much for doing that. All right, Chad, we are in Ezra, of course, and we are in chapter 7. We got through the first six or so verses in the last episode. And we just finally kind of met Ezra, you know. We kind of got introduced to the guy who the book is named after, and we find out that, you know, he's a scribe. He's skilled in the law of Moses, you know. And we also found out that his lineage is pretty good.
Yeah, I'd say. I mean, it goes all the way back to Aaron, Moses' brother. So I'd say it's pretty good pedigree for our friend Ezra. It's kind of funny. I think I said this in the last episode, that you read all these six chapters, you're like, who is this Ezra?
Yeah.
That the book is named after. Then you finally meet him in chapter 7. So yeah, he's a scribe, knows the Torah, and he's got a lot that he's going to be doing. We'll hear more about that in the ensuing chapters. But the first thing we have to do is we got to get him from where he's at to where he's going. So he's among the we don't know how old he is, but he's among the exiles there in Babylon. And we've in these previous episodes we've seen that there's been more than one wave of exiles who have returned from Babylon to Jerusalem. But there's still a lot of people there. In fact, you know, throughout the history of Judaism in Jewish history, from this point all the way for centuries and centuries, I mean, Babylon is going to have a huge Jewish population. If you're familiar with the Talmud, there's actually two Talmuds. There is the Palestinian Talmud, and then there is the Babylonian Talmud. And the Babylonian Talmud is the one we always hear about. It's called that because that's where it was compiled. It was in Babylon. So Babylon remained a center of the Jews, an academic center of the Jews, for a long, long time. And anyway, it started here. But we've got to get this particular guy, Ezra, to Jerusalem so he can start his work there. And in verse 7, we hear that in the seventh year of Artaxerxes, the king, that some of the people of Israel, some of the priests and Levites and singers and gatekeepers and temple servants, they went up to Jerusalem. It's kind of a foreshadowing there. We got to get him there first, but this is going to be the group that goes with Ezra. And so Ezra is going to go to Jerusalem in the fifth month, in the seventh year of that king. And we have some dates here, and I don't know if I want to read. I don't know if I want to read this out of them or not, but I do think it's kind of interesting. First of all, it says on the first day of the month, he began to go up from Babylonia. So first month, he starts out, and then he's going to get there, it says, on the first day of the fifth month. That's when it gets to Jerusalem. So first of all, I was just curious, and I don't know if this is accurate or not, but this is what I was able to find. You know, I've always wondered, and maybe you have too, like how fast can a group like that travel? I mean, think about the wagon trains, you know, if you go on the Oregon Trail or wherever it might be in ancient times before you had modern transportation. You have a group of people, and this is not like a bunch of, you know, young soldiers, but just, you know, families. So you got You got moms, dads, grandmas, grandpas, little kids. So how fast can a group like that move? So it's about 900 miles from Babylon to Jerusalem. It's a long way. I mean, that's a long drive, right?
Yeah. So
900 miles. And it takes them about 4 months. So leave the first month, get there in the fifth month. So that averages about 7.5 miles a day, which Oof. Is just wild to think about. You talk about slow progress. I mean, that's, I can run 7.5 miles, at a pretty good clip.
And you're old.
Yeah. And I'm old. I'm 52 years old. So these people, this group, that takes them a long time because, yeah, they're not even going 8 miles a day. I did look up estimates, and estimates range anywhere from, like, I don't know, like 8 to 15 miles a day is what they estimate for groups like this. But anyway, it takes these people 7.5 miles per day, a long time to get there. Now, another thing I want to point out, too. So I was only able to find one other occurrence of something that happened on the first day of the fifth month. And this might be a tie-in because on the first day of the fifth month is when Aaron, that Ezra is related to, Ezra went up on the Mount Hor and died. So Aaron passes on the first day of the fifth month. And then we have a descendant of Aaron arriving there at Mount Zion, there at Jerusalem on the first day of the fifth month. So I don't know if I want to make anything out of that, but it is an interesting parallel between Aaron and our friend Ezra. But anyway, we'll hear more about their journey and some delays in just a minute, but they're able to make this journey because we were told the good hand of his God was on him, which is a typical kind of a metaphor picture here in Ezra for God prospering their journey. And then verse 10 kind of echoes what we saw earlier back in verse 6, that Ezra had set his heart to study the Torah of the Lord. So the verb that's used there is darash in Hebrew, which is kind of searching out, seeking out. If you've ever heard of midrash, which is Jewish, the Hebrew word for interpretation and application of a text, midrash is formed, there's a noun formed from darash. So you darash a text, you search it out to do midrash. So he studies, he searches out, he seeks to know the Torah of the Lord. And not only did he study it, but to do it and to teach his statutes. So you kind of have this idea of he's studying, but he's also doing, and he's teaching this then to the rest of the Israelites. So that's a little bit about Ezra. And then we have another letter. We have a lot of epistles that are kind of woven into the fabric of Ezra. So we have here a copy of the letter that King Artaxerxes gave to Ezra, the priest, the scribe, a man learned in matters of the commandments of the Lord and his statutes for Israel. And then the copy of that letter is printed, is listed here for us, written here for us in verses 12 and following. Artaxerxes, king of kings, to Ezra the priest, the scribe of the law of the God of heaven, peace. And now, Artaxerxes says, and now I make a decree that any one of the people of Israel or their priests or Levites in my kingdom who freely offers to go to Jerusalem may go with you. So this kind of has echoes of the decree of Cyrus, right? He's allowing people to, hey, if you want to go, we're in charge now. And even though you were brought here as exiles, now we're making the decisions. We're not like the Babylonians, and we're having a lot less, more of a free reign. And so if you want to go, go. And then it goes on, verse 14, you are sent by the king and his seven counselors to make inquiries about Judah and Jerusalem, according to the Torah of your God, which is in your hand. And also, so you're going to make these inquiries. That's what the official proclamation is. And also you're going to carry some silver and gold that the king and his counselors have freely offered to the God of Israel, whose dwelling is in Jerusalem, with all the silver and gold that you shall find in the whole province of Babylonia, and the freewill offerings of the people and the priests vowed willingly for the house of their God that's in Jerusalem. So you're free to go, and whoever wants to go with you, Ezra, and you're going to have a lot of silver and gold. That's kind of, I guess it's kind of the idea. They did kind of a general collection, right? So maybe you don't want to go to Babylon. So maybe, Dan, you're going to go with Ezra, but My family and I, you know, we've been here for a while. Maybe we're farmers. We got lands. We're going to stay, but you're going to go. So, yeah, we want to support our people back in Jerusalem. So what do? We give to you a donation. We say, here, take this for us. You know, when you get to Jerusalem, please pass on our contribution to the temple. So this is our way of, you know, ongoing support for what's happening back in Jerusalem.
Yeah, and that would have been a thing. I mean, if you're a believer in God and you're going to stay behind, you could see how you might be like, well, I'm going to stay behind because I got this or that thing going on here. But I don't want God to be, like, upset or anything. So, I mean, the least I could do is help fund his house, right?
Right.
So
right. Yeah.
I do
yeah.
some of that, you know. It's like maybe you just go to church on Easter and that's it, and that's when you write that big check, you know, like, hey, just so you know, just supporting the, you know, the church. And you gotta remember, I mean, having the temple rebuilt, yes, it's like a religious thing, of course, but it's a pretty big identity thing for your people too. So this is something
Absolutely.
That even if you didn't live there, you would still, this is still a big deal.
Yeah. It's a symbol, and its symbols by the very nature are multifaceted, right? So it's a religious symbol for sure, but it's cultural, it's political, it's sociological, it's historical, it's all those kind of. I mean, the temple is, up until its destruction in AD 70, I mean, that is the hub of the wheel for the Jews. It's the very center of things.
It's like if the White House was also a church, and you know, something happened and it got destroyed, and then you were living in a different place, a part of the world, and they said, hey, we're going to rebuild the White House. And you'd be like, ooh, the White House is sort of like central to like my heritage, and like that's like a big, big deal, right? To me, like the temple is kind of like that. It's a church, yes, but it's also, I mean, it is the building.
Right.
Like if they had money, that's the building that's on it.
Yeah. And there's some theology behind this too, because so even if, so let's kind of go back before the Babylonian exile. If you're living up in the Galilee area, or if you're living in Jerusalem, or if you're anywhere in the Holy Land, then you know that even if you're at home working in the fields, it's not like you're in Jerusalem, there's the temple, but wherever you're at, there is a morning offering and an evening offering that are, I mean, these are offered for you. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it's very different from our idea. You know, it's not like we send people. It's not like, you know, if we stay home on Sunday morning and sleep in, we say to ourselves, well, it really doesn't matter because what is happening in church is done for me. It doesn't work that way. But what's happening in the temple, that lamb that was offered in the morning and the evening, that was for you. Because not you in the sense of you as a independent individual, but you are part of the corporate body of Israel. And so you know that when you offer your morning prayers and you face Jerusalem to do it, that a sacrifice is actually being made there for you, morning and evening. So, even if in this case, if you're staying behind and you're in Babylon, or, you know, in later years when you have the diaspora and Jews are spread all over the Roman Empire, they knew, that still in Jerusalem, there were sacrifices being offered for them. So anyway, they gather all this stuff together, all the silver and gold, all the freewill offerings. And then verse 17 kind of expands on this. It says, and this is more of the decree of Artaxerxes. With this money, then you shall, with all diligence, buy all these animals for sacrifice, bulls, rams, lambs, and also grain offerings, drink offerings. And then you shall offer them on the altar of the house of your God that's in Jerusalem. Whatever seems good to you and your brothers to do with the rest of the silver and gold, you can do according to the will of your God. So you got some left over. Well, you know, maybe the temple needs to be repaired or whatever it might be. Use it for that. The vessels that have been given you for the service of the house of your God, you shall deliver before the God of Jerusalem. And whatever else is required for the house of your God, which it falls to you to provide, you may provide it out of the king's treasury. And I, Artaxerxes the king, make a decree to all the treasurers in the province beyond the river. Whatever, this is great. Ezra, probably when Ezra read this, he's like, oh yeah. Whatever Ezra the priest, the scribe of the law of the God of heaven, requires of you, let it be done with all diligence. Up to 100 talents of silver and 100 cores of wheat and 100 baths of wine and 100 baths of oil and salt without any kind of measurement. whatever is decreed by the God of heaven, let it be done in full for the house of the God of heaven, lest his wrath against the realm of the king, lest his wrath be against the realm of the king and his sons. Okay, we got, I'm almost done with this section. We also notify you that it shall not be lawful to impose tribute, custom, or toll on any of the priests, Levites, singers, doorkeepers, temple servants, and other servants of this house of God. There's a little bit more to it. We'll stop there because there's a few things in there worth talking about. So all these things that are listed here, according to their measurements, some commentators think that that's enough probably to keep the temple going for like 2 years.
Yeah.
It's a lot of sacrifices. So Ezra's basically, I mean, he's given a lot of leeway here, a lot of authority to basically make sure that when he gets to Jerusalem with all the stuff he has, that if he needs more, he can contact whoever's in charge over there and say, hey, you know, Artaxerxes said that you are to provide such and such for the temple in Jerusalem, because Artaxerxes is really serious about making sure that the temple of our God is in operation, full operation. Because, hey, these guys, they believe in a multiplicity of gods, and they're fine with your God, you know, being prayed to for them, or your God being prayed to for them. They want all the people praying to their own gods for their benefit.
This is the thing. When you got the kind of wealth that these kings had, you know, I mean, when you're talking about, you know, Cyrus and now Artaxerxes, you know, this king of kings kind of stuff, right? Which is how he introduces himself. I noticed that Ezra didn't say blasphemy. That's blasphemy. So I reject all of this. He's just going to roll with it. But, I mean, why not? Well, this is all wins. Like, these people are super happy with you. And is their God real? I don't know. But if he is, I've helped his people out. I've got his temple built. And people are going to say, you know, they're going to pray prayers for me. And, you know, I got so much stuff. It's like, it's not a big deal for me to like hedge my bets in this way to say, I don't know, but if that God's real, I'll buy him off. I'm going to pay all this stuff, and that way I won't have to worry about the wrath of this God if the wrath of this God is a real thing. And this is what makes them sort of smarter than a lot of the kings that were before them, because again, you can only have so much stuff, man. Like, yeah. This is not a big deal for him.
It also, you know, in the bigger picture of the salvation story, it's a great contrast to with Pharaoh, you know, who comes across as a total idiot, hard-hearted, you know, dummy, politically speaking, because what happens to him is he gets destroyed.
Yeah.
I mean, completely wiped out through the plagues. And, I mean, that's not bad enough. Then his country still, you know, has a hand over gold and silver. You know, all these Egyptians are... they call it the plundering of the Egyptians, but the Egyptian families were just like, here, take it, go. So the tabernacle was built in the desert with all the things that were taken from the Egyptians. So the same thing is happening here. The difference is that the Persians are like, no, we're all on board with this. So they're the Persian king and the Persians themselves are doing the same thing that the Egyptians did, except they're doing it willingly. Either way, all the silver and gold and the other things that are needed for worship are being provided by God through those who are non-Israelites, which is amazing, which is pretty striking. God is taking care of his people, and he's using Gentiles to do it. And then, you know, we also have here this reference to basically the fact that if you're working at the temple, either as a priest or a Levite or a musician, or, you know, you're guarding the doors, or you're a menial servant, whatever you're doing at the temple, then, hey, no taxation.
Yeah, it's pretty good.
Pretty good deal. And we know from some other Persian documents that this was not isolated. It wasn't like, you know, the Israelites were in a special class and the Persians were like, no, you know, everybody else gets taxed, but you don't. No, this is, you know, it was pretty common in the ancient world for those who were serving some sort of cultic office, some sort of, you know, priestly office, whatever it might be. Well, you get the tax break. So no income tax for you.
Yeah, this is a great incentive to, you know, go to work for the church.
Yeah, that's why everybody's going to seminary these days.
That's right.
All right, we're almost done with the letters. So verse 25 says, verse 25 is going to be the first time that something happens here. So here's the way it starts out. And you, Ezra, according to the wisdom of your God that's in your hand, I'm going to come back to that, but that's what I want to point out. According to the wisdom of your God that's in your hand, appoint magistrates and judges who may judge all the people in the province beyond the river, all such as know the laws of your God. And those who don't know them, well, teach them. Whoever won't obey the law of your God and the law of the king, notice we got two different laws going on here. Whoever will not obey the law of your God and the law of the king, let judgment be strictly executed on him, whether for, and we have a list of four different things that could happen if you don't obey: death, which of course is the worst, banishment, confiscation of his goods, or imprisonment. So let me explain what I was gonna point out here about this wisdom passage. So if you look at some popular Jewish literature later on, such as the Wisdom of Jesus Ben Sirach, which is part of the Apocrypha, and not just there, but a lot of other places in kind of the Jewish popular literature leading up to the New Testament, and certainly after that, very frequently you have the Torah equated with the wisdom of God. And many people think that this is the very first place that this happens. Why? Because if you go back to verse 14, it says, it makes mention of the law of God, which was in Ezra's hand. Now here in verse 25, it says, according to the wisdom of your God that's in your hand. So this might be the first time that where the Torah is equated with wisdom. It's something that happens all over the place in later literature. But anyway, according to either like the fact that you are wise or according to that Torah that's in your hand, whatever is meant here, then Ezra is to do all these things. And those who don't obey, well, they're going to face the penalty, whether that's the death penalty or a lesser penalty.
So these are all similar penalties that we still have, except for the banishment. We really don't have the penalties sort of went away. Not so many people getting banished. Anymore.
No, it was a big thing. I mean, you had people banished all the time. Yeah. Leaders even banished, right? Yeah. You could be banished from a Roman city. You know, if you were causing problems, then you were banished. People banished to islands. I mean, this banishment was kind of a big. Can we bring that back? You think? Is it?
Yeah, I guess there's just not anywhere to banish people to now. What is
the only kind of banishment that happens these days is self banishment. Where you go hide out in Russia or something.
Yeah.
And then you're not really banished because of the internet. So you can be just as visible as you want to be. But banishment, yeah, that was kind of a big deal. Now, wrapping up the chapter, this is verse 27 and 28. We have the first person, the first person reference. So Ezra writes, "Blessed be the Lord, the God of our fathers, who put such a thing as this into the heart of the king to beautify the house of the Lord that's in Jerusalem, and who extended to me." So this is the first I or me that we have in Ezra. This is him actually speaking. So God has extended to me his chesed, his steadfast love, his loving kindness, before the king and his counselors, and before all the king's mighty officers. I took courage because the hand of the Lord, my God, was on me, and I gathered leading men from Israel to go up with me. So Ezra himself is giving thanks to God, blessing God, who he understands is the one who's responsible for all this. Put such a thing as this into the heart of the king, into the heart of Artaxerxes. So, I mean, one of many, many references throughout Old Testament history where a king ends up doing something for reasons that the king is unaware.
Yeah.
So the king, it's not like Artaxerxes woke up one morning and he thought, you know, Yahweh has just really put on my heart to do this thing for Ezra and the Israelites. Yeah, Artaxerxes had no idea whatsoever. He thinks he's doing it for political reasons, but Ezra knows the real reason. So it's a great example where you can look at the same action from very different perspectives, one from kind of a worldly practical perspective, and one from a very theological perspective where we know, oh yeah, the reason this happened is God put that into the heart of the king to make this happen. And he's going to beautify the house. That's language is actually used in Isaiah chapter 60, kind of a vision of people returning from exile and God's house is going to be beautified. So this is echoing Isaiah here. And then Ezra understands this all happens because of the steadfast love, the chesed of his God.
Yeah, you feel like this sort of letter from this king here is like, not the fulfillment of, but like the and a really clear example of Proverbs 21, you know, where it says the king's heart is in the hand of the Lord, like the rivers of water, he turns it wherever he wishes.
That's good.
That's what we just read, right?
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, you can just picture God. He's like changing the direction of the river flow.
Yeah,
because he's the one who's in charge of the hearts of the kings. Yeah, it's great example of that. I mean, it's really when you step back from it, it's a shocking case, really, of how God uses these people who have no faith in him, like Artaxerxes and others. God is just kind of manipulating them. He's using them in a way that's going to benefit his people, as he's done over and over throughout the history of the Old Testament. And you know, as he'll do. Why was Jesus born in Bethlehem? Wasn't like Joseph and Mary thought, man, we
got to fulfill this prophecy.
Yeah, we got to fulfill this prophecy. We can't stay up here in Nazareth. I mean, we got to get down to Bethlehem. No, the only reason they're there is because a decree went out from Caesar Augustus that all the world should be taxed. So God was using, he was in the hearts of kings, Roman kings as well. He was manipulating events to make sure that his will for his people, for us, was done. I mean, what if you're in a congregation that confesses the creed? I love the line, crucified under a political figure, right?
Yeah.
Pontius Pilate. Yeah. So, I mean, another case where God was using a leader outside his own people to make sure that what happened was actually for our salvation.
I mean, it's very unlikely that Mary and Joseph even connected the Bethlehem dots. I mean, we don't get that from their mouth. It's not, I think it's very unlikely that they were even like, oh, Bethlehem, of course, like because, you know, Isaiah or whatever. That's not a thing, dude. I don't think they're doing that. That comes like Herod has to go and ask some like, you know, some learned scribe dude like, hey, where do you guys think it's going to be? I mean, this is easy for us because like we know the whole thing, but you had to go to a studier of the prophets and say, what do you think?
Yeah, it was like, you know, when Mary had her baby shower, somebody gave her a book that listed all the messianic prophecies.
Yeah.
So she and Joseph could like, you know, tick those off one by one. All right, got that
or,
one.
Or when they get, or when they flee to Egypt, they weren't like, of course.
Yeah, I know. Right. Yeah, we read these events, I mean, after they've all happened, and we're like, of course, but they're just, they're trying to get away from bloodthirsty
Herod. Trying to stay alive.
Or they're going down there because of the census. Yeah, they're not sitting around. I mean, Mary, pondered all these things in her heart, but it wasn't like she was thinking, okay, is that messianic prophecy fulfilled? Right now, this one's going to be fulfilled.
They couldn't even be like, Joseph, go grab the Bible off the shelf. I think it says somewhere in here about, like, that's not how things were.
No. Yeah, I don't know if anybody in Israel had, like, in their own house, a copy of all of the Old Testament scrolls.
No.
I seriously doubt that was anywhere. But I don't even know if synagogues had all of the scrolls, but certainly the temple had that. But I don't know if we have any evidence, in fact, if synagogues had all the copies of all the scrolls of all the Old Testament books in first century Israel.
Yes.
Maybe they did. I'm not saying they didn't, but I don't know that we have any evidence of that. But the temple did. But individual people, it wasn't like you know, you got up morning and you You're living there in Galilee, you pour your cup of coffee, and then you open up your Bible and you're going to read Isaiah this morning or something.
No, you
No,
weren't.
you went to synagogue and you heard the Bible read to you.
Yeah, you didn't go and say like, I'm gonna take my messianic prophecy handbook off the shelf here, and since I know that, my wife's got the Son of God in her, and see if I can connect all these dots. You just don't possess this stuff.
I mean, the only book we know they read for sure was Chad Bird's Christ Key.
That's
I
right.
mean, that definitely a bestseller
Definitely. Yeah,
there.
that's the one. That's how that's the
For
one.
first century Galilee. Yeah, everybody had a copy of that. All right, that's the end of chapter 7. Chapter 8 is
Exciting.
where we are. Yeah. So these are we got a genealogy here. Stick with us, folks. Do not stop the podcast. We're going to breeze through this. These are the heads of their father's houses. So this is the genealogy. Ezra says, of those folks who went with me from Babylonia in the reign of Artaxerxes the king. And I am not, I promise, I'm not going to read those. Only thing I'm really going to point out is two things. First of all, there's mention of a Hattush, who is of the sons of David. Now, one of the remarkable things, and it's kind of easy to miss, but one of the remarkable things in much of Ezra and Nehemiah is how little is made of the descendants of David. We heard all about the descendants of David in 1st and 2nd Samuel and 1st and 2nd Kings, so this is all, of course, centered around David and his sons who reigned after him. Well, here's a mention of one, just kind of, thrown in there in this list of other people. And then verse 3 and following has a list of 12 different lay families, about probably 1,500 men or so. So if you add their families to that, we're probably looking around maybe 5,000 people, which is a pretty sizable group that's going to be going up with Ezra. So jumping down to verse 15, after the list of all their names, Ezra says that I gathered these people to the river that runs to Ahava. Babylon was built on the Euphrates River, and there were a lot of artificial canals that are just all over the place for defensive purposes and other purposes too. And this is probably one of those. We don't know where this Ahava is, but it's got to be pretty close to the city. In fact, I think the NIV translates this about they gather them to the canal that runs to Ahava. But either way, that's where they're there. They camp 3 days. And it's like, I don't know what happened, but I guess they're getting everything ready. And somebody's like, hey, are there any Levites here? So they're like, I don't know. Did you look over there? Ask them. Nope, no Levites here. Check some other place. So they go, 5,000 people, not a single Levite in the bunch, which is a problem because this whole Ezra-led group that's going to journey from Babylonia to Jerusalem, this is like Exodus 2.0. So Ezra is a Moses figure. He's got the Torah and he's got these people. And it's like they're leaving Egypt 2.0, but it's Babylonia. And they're going to make this long journey and they're going to do it right this time. Only problem is they can't really do it right because they've got some priests. They don't have any Levites. And what do Levites do? Well, Levites carry the holy stuff of God. And they got some holy stuff that has to be carried. So it's like everything is put on hold.
This is such a weird problem. Right? Like,
Yeah.
how are we going to carry this stuff? We have no Levites.
Right. Right. For us, it's like a practical. We're like, well, I don't know. Get some 18, 19-year-old dudes who can carry anything for all day and let them carry it. But you can't because these are holy things. And the Levites were the guys who they had the wide shoulders, the broad shoulders. They carried all the stuff, all the holy things. And so it's got to be a little bit frustrating because if you're Ezra and you're all these other people, you're like, are you serious? Like, not a single Levite wants to go with us? The Levites are probably thinking, why would I want to go? I mean,
They carry all this stuff.
I got to carry all the stuff. I'm fine here in Babylon. But anyway, he says, I reviewed the people and the priest, and I found there are none of the sons of Levi. So he remedies the situation pretty quick. He gathers together a group of guys. Men of insight, they're called, and he sends them to this place called Iddo. It must have been a bunch of Levites there, and so they go there, and And you start looking around, and he says, again, once more, the good hand of our God was upon us, because they found a bunch of Levites. They found 38. I mean, it's not a bunch, but at least they got 18 from one group, 20 from another group. So now they got 38 Levites. All right. These guys can be doing a lot of work, a lot of carrying.
Yeah.
And a bunch of temple servants, 220 temple servants that we're not told really much about. But anyway, they're descendants of the, I mean, these guys weren't like servants at the temple before the exile, because they'd be way too old for that. But these are maybe their sons or grandsons. So we got 38 Levites, we got 220 temple servants, and now we're almost ready to go. So verse 21 says, before they take off, they're gonna have a fast. So Ezra says that he proclaimed a fast there at the river Ahava. They're gonna humble themselves, could be translated afflict themselves, but there is built into the idea of fasting, that you're humbling yourself before God. Or you're lowering yourself before him. And they're gonna pray to seek from him, it says. We're gonna look from him, seek from him in prayer, a safe journey for ourselves, our children, all our goods. And this next verse cracks me up. So the next verse says this. This is verse 22. Ezra says, for I was ashamed to ask the king for basically an armed escort, a band of soldiers and horsemen to protect us against the enemy our way. Why? Because I had told the king, the hand of our God is for good on all who seek him, and the power of his wrath is against all who forsake him. So they fasted and they implored, they sought the God of Israel, and we're told that he listened to their entreaty.
I like this honesty here. Like, he's like, all right.
It's kind of a welcome human side of these characters, isn't it?
Yeah, they're like, hey, this journey could be dangerous. This king is really just like giving us whatever. I bet you he just like sends some guards, you know, he probably give us an escort. He seems all in on this thing. And I was just like, yeah, here's the thing. I told him, you know, like he is about all this. And one of the reasons he's probably about all this is, you know, I told him, you know, the hand of our God is on people for good if they seek him. And his wrath is against all who forsake him. And really implied that, you know, this God is really powerful. And so I think asking him for an armed escort is really probably going to chip away at the things that I've already said.
It's kind of an embarrassing moment for Ezra. You can tell he's like regretting his decision. I don't know if he spoke in haste or if he was so excited when he found out that, you know, they were going back. He's like, oh, this is great because God is going to watch over us. I mean, we're going to be safe. We don't have to worry about anything because we have such a powerful God.
But super human too, because the implication here is just like, I'd really rather have that arm escort.
Yes. Right.
But I guess we're going to have to just go with God.
Yeah, it's a superhuman moment, because I mean, we've all been in somewhat similar situations, you know, where we, God is fine with us trusting him and also using very practical means.
Chad, we were talking about, we got some crazy weather going on over here. We were talking about tornadoes before we started recording, and imagine there's a tornado coming right at you, and someone's like, okay, what would you rather have? You can have faith in God, or you can have this storm cellar. And you're like, ooh. I mean,
the hand of our God for good is on all who seek him. But that shelter is looking pretty attractive.
It's
right
pretty
now.
Pretty good. Is there a way to do both of these things?
Yeah, can we have both? That was probably
really an either or thing. So in this case, that's just like, yeah, it's neither. Yeah, we can't have both. So we're going to have to just go this route.
Thus the fast before they took off. I don't know that they would have had a fast in this big prayer service if they had
an army,
like,
with them,
you know, a Persian armed guard that was traveling with them. I mean, it's a long journey, right? I said, it's 900 miles. It's going to take them 4 months. That's a lot of chance for some bad people to to attack along
the
way.
Yeah, you got the Persian army with you, and people are like, should we fast? Like, no, I don't think so. I'm pretty sure we're going to make it.
Yeah. So, lesson learned, I suppose, on the part of Ezra.
Yeah, that's awesome. Well, all right, man. Well, we have to leave it right there. The fast has happened. They're going to get after it next week when we continue. And so we will check out how the Levite carrying goes next episode. I'll see you then.
All right, see you then.